and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Robert Eggers' long-awaited sophomore feature, The Lighthouse. I'm expecting that most of our three listeners are probably familiar with Robert Eggers, since The Witch created quite a stir in 2015, and we've been waiting quite a while, as I said, long-awaited sophomore feature for The Lighthouse. For a while, it looked as though his next movie was going to be the remake of Nosferatu that he's been kind of cogitating on, and I was and remain excited for that, but The Lighthouse is certainly not a disappointment. In fact, it's a fucking doozy.
Yes, indeed. Just now, as I frequently do before we start recording, I was Googling the movie just to look up character names and, you know, basic reference points like that, and meant to obviously plug in Lighthouse 2019 as the search query, but for whatever reason, my thumbs elected to type Lighthouse 1919, because this does feel like an antique in a good way. It feels like some weird souped up lost silent feature from time immemorial. You know, that's why you talking about the Nosferatu remake that he's been promising to deliver is just sort of put me in mind of that. I mean, this movie does feel like a part of it is the black and white, part of it is the boxy aspect ratio, but just the framing, the composition, the performances, although it's a sound film, needless to say, it's full of sound and fury.
Signifying all sorts of things.
Yeah, but it is kind of, I feel like you could strip the sound out and just go to town with some like shrieking violins or something, and it would be a very functional silent feature.
Oh,
because
definitely.
It's very imposing to the eye. It's really something to behold.
Yeah, the Nosferatu remake came to mind particularly. And I was going to save this for the post-break segment, but I figure while we're on it, what the hell. There's a shot of the lighthouse and the island, and I think it's when the boat that brought them to the island is receding into the distance, but there's a shot that is like pure Murnau.
Mm-hmm.
Just like looks like it could have been plucked out of Nosferatu if Nosferatu had taken place on an island as opposed to the middle of Central Europe or Southeastern Europe.
Thereabouts, yeah.
But anyway, this film, given the fact that it spends most of its runtime being basically a fucking fever dream, it's going to be hard to summarize, but we're going to go ahead and take a crack at it.
Yeah, I mean, it's either very difficult to summarize or very easy. I mean, it's a two-hander. It's Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe on a rock losing their minds together. It begins with them arriving on the island, where the whole film transpires. They're relieving two other lighthouse keepers of duty, and they're gonna do a month-long stint together, and that's it. We don't know the names of the two departing salty sea dogs.
We don't even see their faces.
We see them
in a very wide shot. Mm-hmm. Walking away. That's it.
As wide as this movie gets, anyway. I mean, the aspect ratio is a little cramped, although I think that works to the movie's benefit more often than not. There's actually a moment near the beginning of the movie where it almost looks like a Looney Tunes-esque, like, duck amuck visual gag, where it appears for a moment that Robert Pattinson bumps his head on the top of the frame. He just goes like, dunk, ah! Like, then, you know, walks into the cabin where he and Willem Dafoe are going to be cohabiting, and things open up a little bit. Although they never open up all that much.
No.
In any case, I had just the biggest grin on my face through this whole movie, even when the bloodletting began and things started getting kind of grim and unpleasant. And the smile first broke out within, I want to say, the opening 2 minutes of the movie, when it's our first good look at Pattinson and Dafoe. They're sort of standing side by side, having just arrived on this island. And Willem Dafoe puts his pipe in his mouth, and it's upside down. And he just kind of gnaws on it, you know, ferociously, the way he does everything in this movie, and indeed most movies that he's in. And there was just something about that that was, I don't know, it just signaled to me that this movie was going to be a really topsy-turvy kind of experience. Just seeing that, it was almost as striking as if he'd, like, put the pipe in the wrong end first. and started chewing on the bit that you're supposed to light. It was just, I was like, oh, this is going to be pure bedlam. I'm so here for it.
So the film starts out, as Matt said, with Pattinson and Defoe showing up on the island, and it begins as sort of this, I don't want to say odd couple, because that makes it sound a little too friendly and like lighthearted, wacky.
Marketable, yeah, right.
But
a classic buddy cop pairing.
Yeah, not so much. Basically, Defoe is this old sea dog.
It's Planes, Trains, and Automobiles with a mermaid. You can put that on the poster.
And indeed they have. Defoe's this old sea dog. His leg is fucked up now, so he's got to keep the lighthouse. Meanwhile, Pattinson, obviously he's younger, but he's kind of green to this whole arrangement. We get the sense, before it's even officially established, this is like his first go-round.
He's not much of a mariner.
Yeah, this is all new to him. And so much of the first 15 to 20 minutes of the movie is just Willem Dafoe shouting at him to keep your duties and, you know, do this task and that task. The accent work for both men is exquisite.
Yeah, the whole film is exquisite. Their performances are just like, they both look like they're rot from the stone that they're standing on. They're so grimy. And yeah, there was a bit, you're talking about Willem Dafoe haranguing Robert Pattinson. There was a bit near the beginning. I don't know if I was just having like a miniature stroke or if someone was dipping into a flask in the theater, but there was a bit near the beginning. It's the bit where Willem Dafoe is talking about how he's going to force Robert Pattinson to polish nails with his mouth, like suck the rust off of them,
yeah.
Where he's like getting right in his face and barking at him. And I was like, I could smell the terrible sailor liquor on his breath. I mean, literally smell it, which is why I thought, like, oh, am I okay? Am I, like, do I need a doctor? And only one other movie has hit me with that kind of, like, smell-o-vision. It was almost some, like, 4D bullshit, you know? I thought that they were, like, piping it into the theater somehow. I haven't had that experience in more than a decade. When I was in high school, there was a fraction of a second where I smelled the Joker's hair in the Dark Knight. It's in the hospital scene where he's like dressed up like a nurse. Mm-hmm. At one point he like plays with his hair and it just looked so greasy and awful that it just like hit me with like a, you know, I don't know. It really took me back. So I can add The Lighthouse now to a very short list of films that have actually stimulated a sense that films are not supposed to stimulate. Very strange. It's just supposed to be sight and sound, but occasionally a miracle occurs. It's weird.
Let me know when you taste a movie, Matt.
I'm very grateful that it was not this one.
Oh, God,
it would
no.
have tasted fucking horrendous.
Yeah, no, it definitely would have.
So right away, Robert Pattinson, who's sort of our eyes and ears and nose, is, as the case may be, is plagued by visions. Nightmares, whatever you want to call them, or fantasies, maybe.
A little of all of those things,
yeah.
Really.
And with a little bit of memory sprinkled in also. He's having visions of this...
Visions?
Of this sea girl, this mermaid, this siren, sprawled out on the rocks, kind of lasciviously.
Making the most heinous fucking... yowling noises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, a shriek fit to drive a sailor mad. I mean, it's like straight out of The Odyssey. It's just like as classic as it gets. You know, it makes you in the theater want to like dive into the ocean just so that you don't have to hear it anymore. He being Robert Pattinson, is also being tormented by a seagull. It seems like that there's one particular seagull that really has it in for him, although I would be hard-pressed to tell two different seagulls apart. I couldn't pick it out of
that motherfucker right there.
I couldn't pick him out of a lineup.
Yeah.
But it really does. He develops an adversarial relationship with one or more seagulls, and he and Willem Dafoe also have an adversarial relationship. Like Jim said, he spends most of his time getting chewed out. And then occasionally, it seems like Willem Dafoe mellows out in the evening over dinner, and the two of them bond a little bit. Dafoe talks about how a seafaring man's greatest enemy is boredom, doldrums, he calls it. Though the phrase that does not come up is cabin fever, although I was reminded very much of the interview scene from the beginning of The Shining, especially when Willem Dafoe started talking about how his last assistant went mad.
Yeah,
it's very, very Grady. It's very Overlook Hotel. Already the claustrophobia is kind of starting to encroach around the corners of the frame. And Willem Dafoe specifically entreats Robert Pattinson in no uncertain terms. He tells him that he is not to go around picking fights with seabirds. Bad luck.
Well, I guess in theory he can pick fights with them, but he just can't end up killing them.
Right.
And we find out later it's because the superstition is that seabirds contain the souls of sailors who died at sea.
Mm-hmm.
So what does Pattinson go ahead and do, like, 3 minutes later?
Kills the shit
the fuck out
of an
of
albatross.
Seagull.
Yeah. He just... it's... he's... hitting it against the rock, he grabs it by its neck, he wrings its neck, and then beats it to death against a rock formation like he's playing a carnival game where he's trying to, you know, like swing the hammer and hit the thing up to the bell. It's like he's really putting his back into it. It's the most passionately committed he is to anything in the movie, which is saying something. I mean, he really has it in for that bird, and the bird had it in for him.
Yeah, it attacked him before he wrung its neck, in fairness to Pattinson. But yeah, no, he's like trying to get a drink of water out of the pump in their kitchen, and it comes out all like gross and slimy and filled with muck. He gets out to the cistern where they draw the water from, and it's got dead birds in it.
Mm-hmm.
And after he finds the dead birds, he gets attacked by a live bird and makes another dead bird.
The seagulls are just such awful little trolls. There's a bit later in the movie where it's sort of the Steve Buscemi's ashes gag from Big Lebowski, but with but with human excrement instead. Robert Pattinson, we're probably not going to end up recounting it in the course of doing the plot rundown because it's not really a major turning point or anything. But Robert Pattinson gets a face full of shit at one point, and seagulls start cackling on the soundtrack like a chorus of tittering. It's like it's literally like they're mocking him, and I was very tickled by that. They're awful, awful animals. So true to form, predictably enough, their luck promptly changes. The wind changes, namely. There's a very ostentatious shot that kind of pans up the lighthouse and shows a weather vane do a 180. They've got a northeasterly wind coming in. It's bringing a bad storm with it. And they batten down the hatches and wait for a ship that's supposed to have two more lighthouse keepers on it who are going to relieve them of duty. And the ship never materializes.
Yeah. And this is where, I mean, already we're questioning Pattinson's sanity and Defoe's sanity, although especially Pattinson's, because he's sort of our POV and he's very unreliable at that. But already we're wondering just how sane he is, and then the ship never comes.
Yeah, the ship never comes, and then what feels like it ought to be the next day in terms of like the editing rhythms of the film. All signs point to one day tops having elapsed.
Well, yeah.
Since the ship didn't show up on time.
Yeah.
And then this very troubling exchange takes place, and the movie like slipped right through my fingers in a way that was very unsettling, where Willem Dafoe says, "What are you talking about? It's been weeks. We're stranded here.
And every day you keep talking about how you can go out in the boat and like row out and find the ship that's supposed to relieve us."
Yeah, exactly.
And Pattinson basically reacts like we did in the audience. Like, wait, what? Like, what are you? That's not funny. What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's so good. Considering we know virtually nothing about this guy, I mean, one more reason to not trust him is that he's very shifty during all of their dinner bonding scenes. He's very much an enigma, a drifter. I mean, Willem Dafoe accuses him of such in those exact words. He's just kind of been bouncing around from place to place. He can't find a job that suits him. He's a mystery man, you know, and he was a mystery man even when time wasn't getting all fucky on us and we didn't have explicit indications that he was not in his right mind. But considering, You know, normally a character being that mad erects a bunch of boundaries between you and them, but I was really on board with this guy. You know, like when Willem Dafoe said, "What are you talking about? It's been weeks since."
Your first thought is kind of like, "Fuck you."
Exactly. I thought I was going to look down and see seagull blood on my hands. You know, it was really. And so then they go outside. They're going to dig up some more provisions. It turns out it's exclusively booze. It's just a big crate of fucking moonshine or something.
Yeah, because Dafoe, the other thing that he says they've talked about dozens of times already, and as far as we know, it's the first time. Until he says as much, he's rationing their provisions because I guess the damp has gotten into their food and ruined a bunch of it. And so after they dig up another crate of booze, as far as I can tell, they never eat another morsel of food for the rest of the film. It is all liquid calories. It is all alcohol.
Yeah, they have...
I think maybe they fish some lobster out of their lobster pots they got out in the sea, but like you never see them eat.
No, yeah, they've just got bellies full of God knows what, and they proceed to just get drunker and drunker and crazier and crazier. A lot of this movie has the same vibe as, well, just Quint's character in general, but specifically the song that they break into after his USS Indianapolis speech. The, "Show me the way to go home, boom." But, you know, that whole sequence where it's just like men on the ocean. I don't know. There's a feeling of like drunken camaraderie, but shot through with something really morbid that just really reeked powerfully of Robert Shaw to me. He would have been
right at home
in this movie. Yeah. And that's basically our game plan going forward. There's a couple pretty funny exchanges that result from that perpetual drunkenness. The most memorable of which is when Robert Pattinson declares he's fantasizing about all the food he would rather be eating than Willem Dafoe's cooking. And he says, "Oh, if I had a steak, a bloody steak, I would fuck it." And Willem Dafoe gets the most crestfallen look. It's the most vulnerable you see him in the entire movie, which is crazy given the state that he's reduced to by the end of it. And we'll get there when we get there. But it's his most human moment. He's like, "You don't like me cooking? You like me lobster? Say it, say it."
And for the next 3 minutes, he's telling Pattinson to admit that he likes his lobster. And finally, when it's clear that Pattinson will continue to refuse, Willem Dafoe invokes the wrath of Poseidon.
He lets out a baleful howl like nothing else I've ever heard. And, you know, and just calls down, you know, he talks about how Neptune is going to flay Pattinson alive with his briny trident and all kinds of Davy Jones nonsense. It's just a litany of sailor imprecations.
And
that
there's no end in sight. And I mean, eventually it does finally stop. But
yeah, it ends on a punchline, which is Robert Pattinson going, "Have it your way. I like your cooking." You know, it's probably the film's funniest moment. The whole movie has sort of a twisted sense of humor about it, but that was the comedic highlight for show.
It was wild.
Pattinson continues to unravel. He is, there's a, more than one scene of him jerking off in this movie, but the last one is sort of the most alarming, where the film is rapidly cutting between him banging this mermaid on a wave swept like rocky edifice and him caressing this little mermaid statuette that he found under his pillow his first night in the lighthouse, and him hauling a crab trap out of the ocean in which he finds a severed human head. And he then corners Dafoe and tries to get him to admit— No, does that come later? Like I said, time is fucky.
I think this is around the same time.
It was close enough in any case. He, in the process of unraveling, divulges to Defoe that he lied about his identity. He, in fact, assumed the identity of an old coworker of his. He used to work in the fucking Yukon somewhere, logging. And he watched a man he was working with get swallowed up by a log jam, just slipped between the logs and drowned. And he could have saved him, but didn't. And it's haunted him ever since. And this is what prompts Willem Dafoe to utter the instantly mimetic, "Why'd you spill your beans?"
Now,
as in, why did you confess your dirty deed? Now, that was featured very prominently in the trailer, that line. And given the nature of their relationship, I assumed that Robert Pattinson had literally spilled some beans
right
on the ground, and Willem Dafoe was hectoring him and telling him to clean them up. But instead,
Pattinson has this confession, and for this like 2 minute stretch of the movie, Dafoe is nowhere to be found.
Yes.
Pattinson like looks up and he's not in the room, looks out a doorway, and then suddenly we're carried down these like dim, fucking horrifying hallways where again and again we just hear Willem Dafoe, "Why'd you spill your beans?"
As if he was sitting right behind you in the theater. Just
like in your ear. And that was second only to the yowling of the mermaid in terms of horrifying.
Yeah, I mean, and then Robert Pattinson tries kind of ineptly to flip it on him, says, "I found human remains just off the shore. You know, I know that you murdered your old assistant, lighthouse keeper."
And this is when Dafoe, if there was any shred of like reality or like grounding in time or anything like that left in this movie, this is where Willem Dafoe like takes it out back and shoots it.
Oh, this is like when he tries to do like the Jacob's Ladder thing, like when he implies
help me to recollect.
Yeah, he implies that Robert Pattinson is not with him on a rock in the middle of the ocean. He is dying of hypothermia, waist deep in snow somewhere in the Yukon. That he says like, "How do you know I'm not a figment of your imagination?" That kind of thing. And yeah,
"How long have we been here? Help me to recollect."
And from here on out, it's just batshit bug fuck rat in a tin shit house lunacy. And I savored every glorious minute of it. At this point, I'm clinging to my notes like a life raft, just trying to, I've got like images in my head and I just can't string them together into a coherent sequence. So I'm looking at my notes and clinging to them like a life raft, and having just said the word life raft, I remember the next event of any consequence, which is that Pattinson tries to take a rowboat out to sea, and Dafoe cries, "Don't leave me!" and starts smashing it to splinters with an axe, then chases Pattinson with the axe all up and down the island.
Willem Dafoe, there's a shot of him capering after Pattinson with the axe, like almost doing a jig across the frame and waving the axe in the air. It was like notes of Leatherface with the chainsaw almost.
Well, yeah, I mean, him running, wielding an axe, especially with the limp, is powerfully Jack Torrance too. It's like, "Dirty!" Like, that's as Shining as it gets.
Absolutely.
And I've alluded to The Shining now, I think at least twice.
I think just twice, but yes.
Yeah, it's got a big stamp on this movie. A lot of horror classics have passed on some DNA to this movie. But yeah, I mean, it's Willem Dafoe plays a madman with the best of them, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's absolutely almost peerless. He pursues him into the lighthouse, and then once again, reality gets you flipped, turned upside down, because Dafoe says that it was Pattinson chasing him with the axe. He says, "You're not in your right head. Give me that knife in your pocket. I can't trust you with it."
And then he gets the knife and he breaks the knife and tells Pattinson it'll be deducted from his wages.
Right. And him saying that is actually the craziest thing that either of them have said in multiple minutes of screen time, maybe upwards of half an hour. I actually have no sense of how long this movie was. It didn't feel over long. Like, I didn't, like, make my ass sore to anywhere near the same degree that It Chapter 2 did, or even Midsommar. Like, Midsommar, which I liked every scene in that movie, but I still felt the length. This was 90 minutes? 2 hours and 40 minutes?
Help me to recollect.
Like, I genuinely don't have the slightest fucking clue.
It was 109 minutes.
It was the perfect length, whatever it was. Yeah. 110, 111, who's keeping track? Not me, clearly. But where was I going with this? Oh, Willem Dafoe acting like they're still going to be paid is the craziest thing that either of... It's just nuts. And him saying it so placidly and so matter-of-factly is scarier than the two of them cavorting and howling and carrying on like two nutcases, which they spend a lot of time doing.
Yes.
They start getting... I guess that the liquor runs out because they start getting drunk on just whatever they've got lying around.
Lamp oil
and all manner of... It reminded me, and I'm going to bring this movie up again after the break, of a Joaquin Phoenix in The Master, just getting shit-faced on anything he can get his hands on.
Yeah.
You know, that's the state that they've kind of devolved to. And Pattinson wakes up one morning, the lighthouse is flooded, a window caved in, a wave came cascading into the lighthouse, and so they're like in knee-deep water, and Willem Dafoe's ledger is floating around, and Pattinson picks it up out of the water and starts reading it. It's a very Shining again. It's a very all work and no play, make Jack a dull boy kind of moment. You just see his horror-stricken face as he flips the pages. And well, we don't see what he sees. He goes to confront Dafoe, basically accuses him of telling fibs in his official ledger, saying that he was shiftless and lazy and insubordinate. But at this point, we have no way of knowing how accurate that assessment actually is. And he looks like a hard worker on the basis of the first act when things were still going according to plan. But this is the least reliable of unreliable narrators at this point. The movie is just a vapor, you know.
Yeah. It's
totally, I mean, open-ended, doesn't even begin to cut it. So this serves as the catalyst for a fatal brawl. They start duking it out. At one point, Dafoe is all done up with clamshells and bits of coral reef. He looks like Neptune, basically. Yeah. He looks like King Triton or something. And Dafoe just beats the ever-loving hell out of him.
Pattinson, you mean?
Sure. Why not?
Dafoe beats the shit out of himself.
Well, actually,
Pattinson's jerking off in the corner.
I mean, actually, at this point, it has been established that these characters do in fact have the same name. They're both actually named Thomas. This comes out when Pattinson admits that he lied about his identity and assumed the identity of his slain coworker up in the Yukon. It's a great little exchange. I'm going to talk about that more after the break, too, if I remember to, when Willem Dafoe is like, "What? I'm Thomas."
I'm Tyler Durden.
Yeah, right. It's hard to, I might as well get into it now. It's hard to do a two people going insane together movie without it just turning into Persona.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment felt especially Persona to me. The lines blurring between where one of their personalities ends and the other begins. There's always some kind of transference that goes on in movies like that. And I'm a huge fan of movies like that. I really like Three Women, the Robert Altman movie. I like Queen of Earth a lot. I could go on and on. The Lighthouse is top tier Persona ripoff, and it's ripping off so many things that you don't even feel. I don't know. It pays homage all over the place in a really kind of artful, delicate way. But this is post break stuff that I'm delving into now. Point being, the final jab before they start throwing punches, before they actually start physically jabbing at one another, is Dafoe calls Pattinson a dog. And so then Dafoe, again, this is sort of a weird transference thing. Pattinson starts telling Dafoe, now that he's got him beat to a pulp on the floor, to bark for him. And then he starts walking him around on a makeshift leash.
And then throws him in the hole where they dug up the liquor and starts burying him.
And there's just this astonishing shot of Willem Dafoe delivering a monologue directly to the camera while presumably Robert Eggers just shovels dirt onto his face.
Yeah, it's like it starts out, it's like his chest and his abdomen, and then gradually a little bit is like getting in his face and getting in his mouth, and eventually he's just like eating dirt and calling out this monologue. And it's just this unbroken shot, and I hope for Willem Dafoe's sake they got it in one take. Because Jesus Christ.
Or that they whipped up some fake dirt that was actually
like Oreos or some shit.
But he it sure doesn't look like it.
No, it looks like he's eaten ground.
Ugh. And the movie's only, the only thing in the movie that even remotely resembles a jump scare, it got a little jump out of the old lady sitting directly in front of us, is when Pattinson goes back into the lighthouse and then Dafoe comes charging in behind him. Pattinson has pilfered the keys off of Dafoe's body. He jumps into the pit, and it looks like he's like brushing dirt off of his face. And
it looks like he's having second thoughts.
Yeah, it looks like he's having a moment of contrition. And then
nope, just ripping the keys out.
Yeah, because he wants to get up to the topmost room of the lighthouse and commune with the light, which he
has been a bone of contention basically the whole movie.
Yeah, right. And Willem Dafoe charges into the lighthouse, streaked with dirt, bellowing about how the light belongs to me. And he buries an axe in Pattinson's shoulder. Pattinson gets the better of him and
puts the axe in his face,
murders him. And then Pattinson communes with the light. And
the third most horrifying moment in the film, I think.
Yeah.
It's one of those super contrasty shots where audio is breaking down. And that always gets me.
Yeah, well, it looks like the movie is disintegrating right in front of you. It doesn't go as balls to the wall with it as I was expecting. I kind of thought, because Pattinson goes up to the light chamber and the light sort of opens up to him. And it almost looks like it's going to be an Ark of the Covenant moment where he just
melts.
He's going to like turn into a puddle of goo. But it's more of a moment of psychological horror, I guess. It always goes back to Kiss Me Deadly, the briefcase in Kiss Me Deadly that has the atomic light pouring out of it. I mean, it really looks like Pattinson is just staring into the abyss in a very Lovecraftian kind of way. Like he is seeing something that it was not meant to be seen, and then he staggers back and falls all the way down the spiral staircase to the base of the lighthouse.
And then somehow by the next shot he has gotten outside and he has had his eyes plucked out by the seagulls, who are now just eating pieces of his flesh.
Yeah, they're feasting on his entrails. It's very Prometheus.
And I think he's supposed to still be alive, so that's great for him. So that was the lighthouse.
Yes, indeed.
We tried to sum it up. I think we did an okay job, but
did an okay job of not talking like a sailor this entire review, which I very much wanted to do. This is the kind of movie that really forces you to be on its wavelength. It turns you into kind of a piratey, cantankerous curmudgeon. We were driving afterward, and there's all month long there's this haunted house in Pontiac that I think at least that's where the light is coming from. There's a searchlight that's been like a fucking bat signal that's been carving up the night sky the past several weeks, and watching it tonight I could hear the blaring, honking, Inception-y like that this movie is full of.
Yeah.
Every time
the foghorn,
that foghorn noise. Every time you see the lighthouse off in the distance, it's good stuff. I really feel like we ought to be recording this episode in a windswept shanty somewhere. I feel like I need
the
to
audio
hear
wouldn't be for shit.
Creaking floorboards and squawking gulls and crashing waves. It's just I don't know. I can hear them in my head.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna go ahead and take our break. And we'll be back with more of our thoughts in just a moment.
Keeping secrets, are you?
No, sir.
Watch you spill your beans.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break, to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
How long have we been on this rock? 5 weeks? 2 days? Help me to recollect.
And we're back. So, Matt, have at it.
Well, okay. So I was... The Lighthouse, 1919, directed by Robert Eggers. You know, I mean, it feels like an instant classic. I mean, it just there's a reason that my thumbs did that. And it's not just because, I mean, I would understand if you loyal listeners thought that I was coming unglued a little bit after what I just said before the break about hearing the gulls and the waves and so on and so forth. But I mean, I don't know. I'm shook in just the best possible way. I mean, there's a particular, you can't even call it a subgenre, a subcategory of horror that's in vogue lately. It's just happened just in the past 4 or 5 years. Blumhouse's reign of terror is not coming to an end anytime soon, but there's new game in town in the form of like A24 horror. It's a thing now. I mean, yes. It's here to stay. And I couldn't be more thrilled because I like highbrow horror. I like art house horror. I like horror that is really striving for something. Even when it misfires, it's damn near my favorite kind of movie. And there's just been a lot of it lately. I mean, I've been feeling a little bit blessed this year because Ari Aster, Robert Eggers, and Jennifer Kent all had new movies coming out. And that is a good year for Matt Gerendasi. You know, we're talking, you know, this is Babadook, Hereditary, Midsommar, The Lighthouse, The Witch. It's just, and the Nightingale is Jennifer Kent's new one, which is probably my film of the year, at least so far. I mean, November, December could fucking wreak havoc on my half-assed top 10 list, you know,
often does,
as they are wont to do. But Lighthouse is right up there too. Like Nightingale and Lighthouse are vying for that top spot. It's just a damn good time to be a horror fan, specifically a horror fan with my kind of highfalutin art house fort house inclinations. There's a particular kind of just when I said before the break during the plot rundown that Willem Dafoe's line about Robert Pattinson spilling his beans was instantly mimetic. I think that there's a lot of that going around too. I remember the marketing for Midsommar leaned into that even more. I saw one trailer that was cut to sort of hype up the Midsommar festival like it was Bonnaroo or something. And there was another, like, almost Adult Swim kind of Too Many Cooks sort of ad that was shilling for Midsommar action figures. Did you ever see this? There was
No, I missed that one.
A bear in a cage toy, and there was a little commercial jingle that went along with it.
Jesus.
It's a bear. It's a bear in a cage. Like, you know, and The Lighthouse wasn't that obnoxious, but it still, that trailer where Willem Dafoe just says, "Why'd you spill your beans?" innumerable times, they knew exactly what they were doing. I mean, these movies are really funny in a way that in sort of a sneaky, underhanded way that I don't know. It's firing on all cylinders, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, and it is also disturbing stuff, as you know, which I hope we conveyed during our pretty exhaustive and probably pretty incoherent plot synopsis. So I don't want to make it just sound like a lark or like you know.
Yeah, no. And while what you're saying is true of Midsommar and other these art house horror movies that we've seen and we love and are great, but it seems to me to be most true of The Lighthouse. Because as much as we spent more or less the entire movie unsettled and then horrified and then gibbering in a corner like a shivering mess
trying to wash the seagull blood off our hands, yeah,
I also spent a lot of this movie laughing, and sometimes it was just almost inadvertent, like I couldn't help myself.
I said very near the beginning of this episode that I had a huge ass grin on my face the entire time, never more so than when Willem Dafoe invoked Poseidon and started like he did. It was almost like a weird monkey see monkey do thing that like it hit me on, you know, jump scares want to make you jump, a tearjerker wants to make you cry, I don't know what this moment wanted me to do, but it got like a physical reaction out of me, which is that when Willem Dafoe like went whoo and like clenched his fists and like lifted his arms up as if he was challenging God to a fist fight, I did the same thing. I was like in my chair just going like whoo. I wasn't making a noise, you know.
I can but, confirm this. This is a thing that happened.
It was just like a bolt of lightning just came crashing through the roof and just hit me right on the right there on the spot.
And you know, the rule is with a horror comedy, the good ones, you know, and this is not a horror comedy per se. I don't want to give that impression, but the rule with horror comedies that are supposed to be the good ones are that it manages to be scary even while it is a funny movie and good in that sense.
Yeah.
But like, this is fucking next level. I mean, this is like, this is so much more horrifying than any like ordinary horror comedy I've ever seen. And again, there's so much of it that's just, you can't help but laugh because it's nuts.
Well, and yeah, speaking of, as I said a minute or two ago, Art House Fart House, there's just a ton of flatulence in this movie. To Willem Dafoe is just constantly ripping ass. Just in the middle of dialogue exchanges, you'll just hear a surreptitious little pfft. And it's very juvenile, but and it's, you know, it's funny at first, but then you start to think, God, actually rubbing elbows with this person for weeks and months at a stretch, living in a dingy little cabin that smells of stale Willem Dafoe farts, anyone would lose their marbles, you know. And Robert Pattinson, even when he hits his breaking point at the end, I'm sick of this, I'm sick of that, I'm sick of your farts. That's the note that he ends on. I'm sick of your farts. And he just like describes the smell in a very loquacious kind of way. And it's like, yeah, I mean, that is awful. I mean, so the comedy compounds the horror in a strange way. It kind of like what starts as a joke curdles into something a lot more sinister. That's one of this movie's better sleights of hand. And I guess, I don't know, that's why I went on that digression about the marketing for Midsommar, because the comedy it was the case in that movie. What I likened Midsommar to the Firefest documentaries,
mm-hmm.
in the sense of like creeping schadenfreude that kind of snuck into it, which does make it perversely enjoyable in a way that I was not expecting it to be. And here, I don't know, I saw people on the internet likening it to SpongeBob a lot. Like, Willem Dafoe is kind of putting on a Mr. Krabs voice. I remember I saw one YouTube comment in particular that said, this reminds me of the episode where SpongeBob and Mr. Krabs try to kill the health inspector. And I was like, yeah, honestly, they're not that far removed from one another, except that,
been reduced to a gibbering, shivering puddle SpongeBob.
Yeah, but there is a whiff of hash-slinging slasher about this movie. That's like, I would be remiss in my duties if I didn't point that out. Its influences are manifold. I mean, I talked about The Shining a lot. I brought up Jacob's Ladder persona. It also reminded me a lot of Hour of the Wolf, which is Bergman's follow-up to Persona. There's an interlude in Hour of the Wolf where Max von Sydow murders a boy on a beach apropos of nothing. It's a traumatic memory. He's like flashing back to something that he's done in the distant past, and the visions in this movie of the back of the other logger's head. He's got this kind of head of blonde hair, and you never see his face, you just see the back of his head. And you later learn that Robert Pattinson was contemplating killing him before he slipped and fell in. Whether he actually slipped or was pushed is anybody's guess, but that was very much an Hour of the Wolf thing. I don't know, I'm not just going to keep rattling off this movie's various allusions, because I'm sure there are some that I missed, but it's steeped in cinema history. I mean, it looks, and Jim, you said it yourself, like one of the opening shots of the movie is pure Murnau. It's got a timeless quality, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, because it's pulling from all these different sources, all these different reference points throughout movie history. It kind of, that's what gives it its instant classic stature, at least in my eyes. And I felt the same way about The Witch. So he's really hit two movies out of the park for me.
Yeah.
So far.
And speaking of the witch, and I'm about to say something that has been frequently and repeatedly observed, so I'm not trying to claim that this is some kind of insight, but Robert Eggers, at least within the horror genre, is the undisputed, unparalleled master of period detail. Like,
and accent work, particularly.
Especially.
Like,
but I mean,
well,
like,
he likes, clearly, on the basis of these two movies, he likes challenging himself to write in dialects. That really impenetrable. Like, occasionally, especially in this movie, it was true in The Witch, too. Sometimes you're only catching every third word, and you're just hanging on these lines being spoken and trying to sort of grab at context clues and connect the dots. It really makes you engage in the movie in a much more active way. It made me grateful that there weren't subtitles, because you kind of almost find yourself like physically leaning forward in your seat trying to cut through all the sailor jargon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's a total whiz kid with period detail.
And I mean, he comes from the background of being a production designer. Like, you hop on Robert Eggers' IMDb profile, and there's like a few dozen films, short films, whatnot, that he did production design for before he shot The Witch, mm-hmm. and obviously this. So it stands to reason that that's the background he came from, and apparently he was real good at it.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a great eye. Even the stuff in this movie that ought to look totally alien looks, you know, admittedly, you don't see that much tentacle action. There's a little bit near the beginning, and then again during the brawl where Willem Dafoe turns into Poseidon. You know, there's some flailing tentacles in the background, and they're not claymation. It's hard to say what they are, actually, but they look a little Harryhausen-esque. They look a little Clash of the Titans in a good way, that I think also contributes to this movie's timeless quality. Everything is just, you know, visually, I mean, the movie, it's just impeccable, even more so than The Witch was. I mean, it just never sets a foot wrong in terms of the framing, the composition, camera movement. There was one very, I don't know, it hit me like a gust of wind. It's Pattinson's first encounter with the seagull. And up to this point, the camera's been very static for the most part. He scares the bird off by throwing a rock at it. And as it takes flight, the camera sort of orbits around Robert Pattinson in a way that almost feels like the camera is also flying away. but it's not as over the top as that makes it sound. It's just like a very quick, fluid movement, kind of pirouettes around him and then comes to a stop again. It's just like the hint of him having just meddled with a force beyond his understanding. That, like, it imparts a lot of power to the seagull, that the seagull taking flight is the first thing that really gets the camera to, like, rouse itself from its stupor, mm-hmm. you know, stand up and take notice. The movie is full of stuff like that. I stopped even appreciating little flourishes like that after a certain point, because the movie is so chock full of them that it spoils you. So that's something that subsequent viewings will certainly tease out, I think. I don't rewatch a lot of movies, but I'm looking forward to this one hitting home video so that I can just get lost in the waves and the brine and the wind and what was I talking about?
Home video.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I I'm gonna hop on my personal hobby horse here for a second. I like to bitch from time to time about the kind of resurgence in the 4:3 aspect ratio that we've seen over the past
decade.
Arnold's been doing it for like a decade and a half,
right.
But really it seems like the last 5 to 6 years it's become a super big thing. And most of the time, like even in a movie that I'll end up liking, the aspect ratio will still be distracting for me. Because I had this very deliberate process of when I started watching DVDs when I was 10 or 12 or whatever.
Always making sure you got the widescreen edition.
Right, because it was when it was finally brought to my attention that
you were getting ripped off.
You were getting ripped off because the sides were getting cut off of your movies. It was just burned into my brain, like, if it's not 16:9 or one of the wider aspect ratios or whatever, then it's wrong. You're missing things. Something's being cut off. and it can get distracting for me. And I'll grant you, while I was getting into this movie, I was still having that. But after like 5 or 6 minutes, that's gone. And it takes a lot for me to get past that, particularly so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, any movie that you get absorbed in, ideally, you're supposed to forget that you're even sitting in a theater or looking at a screen that has certain dimensions. Aspect ratio ought to be the last thing on your mind if the movie is working its magic on you. I mean, I think I remember Meek's Cutoff is kind of the epitome of this for me. I remember watching that movie and then like subsequently reading reviews of it. And I normally do it in that order because I don't want to bias myself. Not always, but I try to be rigorous about that. And I saw people complaining about its boxy aspect ratio. And it was only then that I realized that it had been shot in that format. It hadn't even... So, yeah, I mean, a good movie is... And Meek's Cutoff, the reason I bring that movie up is because it's a Western. There's a lot of, like, wide-open shots of the prairie and the plains, and it never feels cramped, despite modern viewers feeling that, like, they're entitled to more screen space. So it's all about... If it's a capable filmmaker, you kind of just have to trust that you're in good hands, that they're going to shepherd you through this experience, and if they only want to give you a smaller window on the action... then presumably they have a good reason for doing so. Now, I don't think that that's universally the case. I think that sometimes using a slightly outmoded aspect ratio can be a little bit of a contrivance, but not in this case. Honestly, the movie being presented the way it was is what sold the silent movie
thing. Because it wouldn't have made any sense. Like, oh, yes, this looks like Cabinet of Dr. Caligari in glorious fucking Panavision or whatever. Like, that wouldn't have made any fucking sense.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's funny, too, that I thought about The Master so much while I was watching it. I'm about to harp on this a little bit more. I mentioned briefly before the break that their drinking habits started to remind me of, I think the character's name is Freddie Quill. In The Master, the Joaquin Phoenix character, the PTSD-riddled veteran who's absorbed into a Scientology-esque cult run by Philip Seymour Hoffman. The Master, it was I saw it for the first time in 70mm.
You fortunate motherfucker.
The furthest fucking thing from, like, I don't know. I mean the shots of, like, Philip Seymour Hoffman on a motorcycle... just tearing ass across the desert where it feels like the screen, like it's so expansive. It feels like it like wraps around behind your head practically. Like you could do a 360 in a swivel chair and there would still be more to see. The Lighthouse is the furthest thing from that. And yet I felt a certain, well, okay, I'll stop beating around the bush. The reason that I was thinking about The Master as much as I was, it wasn't just because they started imbibing motor oil or whatever else. I had an insight, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to feel this way about these movies, but I had an insight recently about a pair of Paul Thomas Anderson movies, The Master and There Will Be Blood, which are both about, well, in the case of The Master, it's a little bit more nuanced, but in There Will Be Blood, it's a rivalry between the Daniel Day-Lewis character and the Paul Dano character, who just hate each other's guts from moment one, and that's the backbone of the movie. And then in The Master... you have, again, these two male figures. What I kind of was struck by was that either of those movies, these are guys, the four of them, who could support an entire movie by themselves. They've got enough going on that they could carry a big, epic, important movie on their backs, like Atlas carrying the globe, no problem. But you stuff two of them in the same movie, and they kind of have to start butting heads because the movie is like, you know, this town ain't big enough for the both of us. You know, it's like it's either of them could carry a movie, but they almost can't share the same movie, not peaceably anyway. And I thought about that over and over again watching The Lighthouse. That's like you could make a good movie about either one of these guys, but if you put them in the same movie, it's like they have to destroy each other. They don't have a choice. They're so larger than life that, yeah, one of them has to crowd the other out. And that's the dynamic in There Will Be Blood. That's the dynamic in The Master. It happens again here, and it's just dynamite. It's such a surefire way of generating tension and stakes and, you know, just capital D drama. It's really, the movie feels huge despite the fact that it's just two actors in a room together, basically, and then a couple exterior shots.
Yeah. Sorry, when you said stakes, I just thought about Robert Pattinson fucking one. So.
Okay. I thought that was going to be a Twilight thing. I was like, what, stakes?
Vampires? No, Matt. Why'd you even...
Look, I mean, I'm not...
We managed not to bring up Twilight the whole time.
I don't even... I am no longer haunted by the specter of Twilight. I mean, I'm not... You see people shitting their britches over Edward Cullen being Batman or whatever, and it's just like, move on with your lives.
Yeah, no, I mean, I ragged on Robert Pattinson for a long time, but he's... The man's paid his dues, I think.
Yeah, I mean, his work in this movie, it reminded me of Lost City of Z. More than anything, he turns in a very quirky supporting performance in that movie. He's doing a weird voice. He's very scraggly and disheveled, kind of gaunt, bearded. That felt like a dry run for the kind of stuff that he does in this movie. Although Robert Eggers cranks it up to 11 and Defoe and Pattinson both follow suit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because the impression I got watching the trailer is in the trailer, you just see a glimpse of some thrashing tentacles. I don't even think you see a mermaid in the trailer, maybe like a bit of a tail or something, but you just get little hints of the madness that this movie has in store for you. And so then you think, all right, I bet that there's a lot more of that, and the movie is just keeping it up its sleeve. You know, the marketing department is just keeping it on the DL. And then, in fact, the movie is both way crazier than the trailer suggests, but also in terms of its actual content, it's exactly what the trailer showed you. I mean, you see about as much tentacle action in the movie as you saw in the trailer.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few seconds more of it, but literally that's it. But the cumulative effect of all of it, it just knocks you out. I mean, it's deeply deranged. I mean, some of the shots near the end when the lighthouse is flooded, there's water coming down through the ceiling beams. And they're dancing arm in arm. I didn't even touch on this. There's a homoerotic element that emerges with the two of them being cooped up together for so long, which also reminded me of The Master more so than There Will Be Blood, because there's a, you know, the movie is a little bit of a love affair, platonic love affair between the Joaquin Phoenix and the Philip Seymour Hoffman character. Here, things get a little bit more physical, and then their no homo instincts kick in,
and they start fist fighting.
Put up your dukes. Pattinson literally strikes the leg.
Literally fist.
I'll pepper
pose.
Your porridge. Kind of. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Speaking of persona and homoeroticism, correct me if I'm wrong. There's lesbian overtones near the middle of that movie. Right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I haven't watched Persona in like a dozen years. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has been an age.
Yeah.
But yeah, no. But there's just some shots of them carousing drunkenly where it's like where you know where normalcy has broken down to such a state that it's more like bearing witness to a witch's Sabbath or something. Like there's just something genuinely wrong happening in front of you, and I likened it to Robert Shaw's
Show Me the Way to Go Home,
yeah, sailor songs in Jaws. It's like that on mescaline, you know. It's just totally yeah, I mean, it's just a nightmare. Just a seafarer's nightmare, you know? I mean, it feels like it was dredged up out of the ocean. It feels like when they, like, bring the reels of film. I know that it's the projectors, modern theaters don't even work this way anymore, but I feel like there should be, like, starfish clinging to the reels of film, you know?
You want to talk about some Davy Jones
when they thread it through the projector, you know, they should have to, like, swat away the crabs.
And pry off the barnacles.
Yeah, exactly. It's good shit. I guess in closing, is gonna by nature of this being the end of the episode, this is can only be the last time that I bring up The Shining. There's a great clip. It's from a making of documentary about The Shining shot by Kubrick's daughter, where Jack Nicholson is getting himself psyched before he does the Here's Johnny scene when he axes down the bathroom door. He's in the hotel room with the axe in hand, and he's stomping his feet and kind of spinning around and getting himself hype. And what he's saying is,
axe murder, kill, 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 axe murder, kill, kill. I wanted to mutter that under my breath, like on my way out of the theater. That's, I think, was the my first overriding impression of this movie, was that it got me to a point where I was a little bit manic and a little bit out of my mind in a really pleasing way. And I felt like I was channeling some, some Jack Torrance energy. It doesn't hurt that the movie ends with an axe murder. I think at one point in my notes, the page literally just says axe murder, kill, kill, kill.
It's okay. We won't let anybody look at your notes.
Yeah, I would just hate to like die suddenly and have someone find them in a drawer.
Don't worry. I'll burn them if anything happens to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Unless, of course, you spill your beans and kill me.
I've already spilled my beans here on the podcast.
Well, you know, son of a bitch.
Yeah, cat's out of the bag now.
This may be the last episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. If so, it's not a bad note to go out on.
No.
Anyway, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Jim. And we are the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from The Lighthouse, official trailer HD, A24, uploaded by A24. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, November 10th, and we'll finally get the chance to discuss Bong Joon-ho's new film, Parasite. See you then.